People First Radio is a program about people, the society in which we live, and issues related to health and wellness.
Welcome to People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh. Today on the program, basic income in the spotlight. A guaranteed basic income program would reduce poverty rates in Canada by 40%, according to the Office of the Parliamentary Budget Officer. We're going to spend the next hour digging into what that means. Let's start with some definitions. Guaranteed basic income is a framework that would provide everyone with a minimum income, which could come in the form of regular payments from the government using the tax system. There are all kinds of different ways it could be implemented. We'll get into some of the specifics a little later on. The Parliamentary Budget Officer, or PBO for short, is a neutral and non-partisan agent of Parliament. Yves Giroux has been in the role since 2018. The job of him and his office is to provide senators and members of Parliament with economic and financial advice. The latest analysis from the office is about guaranteed basic income. It was prepared by two folks who we'll hear from on the show.
My name is Nasruddin Ammar, and I am an advisor analyst with the Parliamentary Budget Officer.
And my name is Marianne Lohe, and I'm an analyst at the Parliamentary Budget Officer.
While this latest analysis on guaranteed basic income was just published in February, the PBO has been studying the topic for around 7 years.
The analysis of GBI has evolved significantly over the years, reflecting both political interest and economic realities. So the discussion began in 2018 when a parliamentarian formally requested that the PBO estimate the cost of implementing a national GBI program. At that time, the focus was primarily on understanding the financial feasibility of such a program, how much it would cost, and what fiscal mechanisms would be required to support it. This initial assessment laid the foundation for further discussions by providing a baseline understanding of the financial implication of GBI. And then the conversation around basic income gained significant traction in 2020, largely through the COVID-19 pandemic and the introduction of the what was called the Canadian Emergency Response Benefit, the CERB. As you know, many policymakers and social advocates and citizens saw CERB as a kind of form of temporary basic income at that time, demonstrating how direct financial support could help individuals facing economic hardship. So this sparked renewed interest in GBI from parliamentarians, leading the PBO to update its 2018 cost estimate. And then building on that, in 2021, at the request of several parliamentarians, the PBO expanded this assessment beyond just cost estimates, and the focus shifted to distributional and fiscal impacts, aiming to understand how different income groups will be affected if GBI were implemented.
In its analysis of a guaranteed basic income, the PBO decided to use a model from Ontario. In 2017, the Ontario government started a pilot project that provided a basic income to 4,000 participants. That project was cancelled early when the Ontario government changed in 2019. But when the PBO started looking at basic income, back in 2018, remember, it was still going on.
And given that the PBO mandate, we don't have the authority to propose policy parameters ourselves. We can only assess proposals based on existing frameworks or requests from parliamentarians. And in 2018, the Ontario pilot GBI program was still active, making it the most concrete and structured example of basic income model in Canada.
So how does the model work? How much money would people get?
Basically, in that GBI model, eligible participants would receive up to 75% of what is called the low income measure. And then the benefits would be adjusted based on income sources. So in our report, so in 2025, single individuals would receive up to $21,900 approximately. and couples would receive up to 30,795. And then people with a disability would receive a universal additional amount of 7,355 per year. And then the GBI amount people would receive would then be reduced as family net income increases at a rate of 50 cents for every additional dollar of family net income.
So if I am an individual, I'm living in Canada, and this program were enacted, I would get around $21,000. That would be my guaranteed basic income. And if I were to earn income myself, for every $1 I earn, I would get 50 cents less than the $21,000.
Yeah, exactly. And then that amount would be adjusted depending on the number of adults that there is in the family. And it also depends on how we define a family.
That last point is one of the big new updates in the PBO's work. Previously, they'd been focusing on the idea of a nuclear family, which meant couples, and if they had any children under 18, would be grouped into the same household. Adult children, who might still live in the same home, would count as their own family for the purposes of the basic income program. This time around, the PBO still crunched the numbers on the nuclear family scenario, but they also took a look at what they defined as an economic family. Anyone related by blood or marriage living in the same house, no matter how old they are or what the relationship is. Doing that cut the gross cost of the program by half. It went down from $106 billion to $53 billion. In their analysis, that cost would be offset by changes to the tax system.
We assume in our framework that the GBI would replace those tax measures and federal provincial tax credit that are intended for low income individuals. So the first step in our analysis is to identify those programs that are directed to low income individuals and families. We have a list of them provided in our report. And then by eliminating that covers a significant portion of the cost, but not entirely. The remainder of that cost is covered by reducing the basic personal amounts, the federal and provincial ones. And so what we do is we reduce that amount up until the saved expense, government expense, would cover all of the GBI gross cost. And so by definition, we ensure in our analysis that the net cost of the program, excluding the behavioral response, but the net cost of the program and the disability amounts that are given would be essentially near zero.
You're listening to People First Radio. We're talking about guaranteed basic income on today's program. Nasruddin Ammar and Marianne Laurent both work in the Office of the Parliamentary Budget Officer. It's a nonpartisan agency that provides financial and economic advice to parliamentarians. They put together an analysis that suggested guaranteed basic income could reduce the poverty rate in Canada by 40%, and that the costs of the program could be offset through adjustments to the tax system.
We estimate that the GBI could reduce national poverty rates by 34% when we use the nuclear family definition and 40% under the economic family definition. That's for 2025. These numbers are slightly lower than our previous estimate that we had in 2021. And that would reflect recent increases in the MBM threshold. That means increases in the estimated cost of living, and also the fact that low income earnings haven't necessarily kept pace with that, which means that more families may be classified as living in poverty. So that would be like our main finding related to poverty levels from our report.
So 40% of people living in poverty would be lifted out of poverty, suggests a report, if you use the economic family definition. As economists, what would be some of the like potential ripple effects of that, again, from an economic standpoint in terms of costs of other things, other programs, etc.?
Actually, that's a great question. I mean, you treat something that we didn't really consider it in our report. And that kind, what we called, like economists, called cost-benefit analysis of the GBI, which is not undertaken, is not, it's out of the mandate of PBO, but you're right about that. So, I mean, there are a lot of broader economic and social benefits or impacts from implementing GBI and from reducing the poverty, right? Like health outcomes, education attainment, crime reduction, and overall social well-being. All that effects could be important actually, but it's outside the scope of the analysis. So the GDI could play a significant role, but is not. We don't know exactly how that will be affected. The other thing that our behavior impact assessment in our report is partial in nature. So the report focuses primarily on the effect of GBI on labor force participation, for example. That's one of the economic effect. So estimating how financial transfer may alter worker incentives. However, this is just one dimension of behavioral response. So other direct and indirect behavioral effects such as change in consumption patterns, for example, due to increased disposable income are not explicitly modeled, but could be another economic effect of reducing the poverty and increasing the economic well-being of families, right? Changing in household spending behavior could have multiplier effects on the economy that are not captured in the analysis.
This week, I also spoke with Tracy Smith Carrier. She's a professor at Royal Roads University in Victoria. She's also the Canada Research Chair in advancing the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals. She was one of the speakers at a webinar on advancing basic income held by Waterloo, Ontario-based charity, the Tamarack Institute. So far on the show, we've been talking about guaranteed basic income. You might have also heard people talk about universal basic income. I asked Smith Carrier about the difference between those terms.
The universal basic income term, I think, really was animated in the United States with Andrew Yang and that whole crew that was really trying to promote this idea. And it's been taken up, you know, globally. It is a bit different than what folks in Canada are advocating for. So the universal basic income is really a universal basic income, meaning everybody in a given society would receive it and they would receive the same amount. And so lots of debates, obviously, about the, you know, the pros and cons of doing it that way. It would largely probably be very expensive to ensure everybody received that. I mean, there are some things you can do to tax back so that people on the, you know, highest on the income scale get that money taken out. But initially, it could be a very expensive program. People in Canada have largely advocated for forms of a basic income guarantee. So we use the term BIG, basic income guarantee, or guaranteed livable income, as opposed to the UBI model. That model, the basic income guarantee model, is about ensuring that people, I guess universality of access is what we really would like to achieve. Anybody who needs to access it would be able to access it. So that means it's really sort of targeting those who don't have sufficient income to meet their basic needs. And it would basically be very sensitive to people's income. So it would increase as people's income declines. So that is quite different than a model where everybody gets like $200 a month type of thing.
Really pragmatically speaking, how does the implementation of that work? Like, if there is this test, this threshold that I need to pass to get the money?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think we already have forms of basic income already in our tax system. So the Canada Child Benefit actually was originally a Dema grant. Kind of anybody who had a family, had children, would get, you know, $200 a month. I mean, there were some variation based on kids' ages and whatnot, but it was basically a form of a Dema grant, and it got changed and they made it subject to income. So it became more of an income supplement mechanism, sort of similar to what we're advocating for through basic income, sensitive to people's income. And so that really actually allowed for the poverty line to really drop. Up until 2020, things were really on the decline for poverty, largely because they made the Canada Child Benefit like a basic income and made it an income supplement mechanism for families. So those that, again, were in the lowest quintiles for poverty would see the greatest benefit. We also have had in Canada basic income pilot projects. So the Mincom project that happened in the 1970s, and the project that the Ontario basic income pilot that was that ran for a little less than 2 years and was prematurely cut. Those and we're collecting data from Evelyn Forget has done a lot of work on the Mincom project, and quite a few people now have stepped in to work on that. We're starting to see now research coming out of the Ontario Basic Income Pilot. Those programs were structured in the same sort of basic income guarantee approach as opposed to the UBI model. So we already have some experience and some evidence around how do we structure this thing to make sure that it is the most robust measure that we can to reduce poverty in this country.
The idea being that you file your taxes maybe for the year, and as long as your income was under whatever threshold it would need to be, then you would sort of be enrolled in the program where you would receive the income supplement?
Well, this is the thing. It could be rolled out in a number of different ways. You know, there are lots of different, you know, the way that we've structured the Canada Child Benefit, or the, like I said, the Guaranteed Annual Income Supplement. You know, essentially the federal government just, you know, deposits money into your bank account type of thing. The way they structure it, and obviously we don't know how exactly they will structure it, in what way, in terms of refundable tax credits or even a Dema grant model, if they went that direction, we're not sure. But some of the costing, I think, that we're seeing coming out of the Parliamentary Budget Officer's office is really interesting, because I mean they did some costing in 2021, and at that time the assumption was that it would seem to be the price tag was really quite high. So kudos to the people that were doing some work in the, to get a demonstration project in the province of PEI, because they did some modeling there to say, well, you know what, let's change the unit, the family unit in which we would administer this benefit. And by making some of those changes, they were able to realize some significant cost savings. So the Parliamentary Budget Officer did something similar in terms of, you know, trying to model with the nuclear family versus the economic family. And when you did that, you basically have like can cut the cost in half of what you would expect to just by changing how we define the family and who's included in it. So so that's substantial, because it then says this is an affordable thing that we can do. We don't have to have people struggling and in such depth, the deep income poverty that is really starting to climb in this country. We can nip it in the bud. We can move away from demoralizing social assistance programs. We can envision something better and something far more effective in addressing the roots of financial hardship.
Now, the Parliamentary Budget Officer's office, they aren't really allowed to advocate for any kind of policy or develop or suggest new policies, as they said to me earlier today. What do you think it's going to take for something like that to actually be implemented?
Yeah, I mean, that is the topic that we've been talking about a lot lately, about how do we move this strategically. And personally, I think it will involve a multi-pronged approach, recognizing we don't necessarily know what is going to be the most effective thing. So we're involved in doing social media campaigns. We're involved in doing, you know, direct meetings with politicians and trying to get people to sign on to our consensus statement about the basic income we want in this country. I think trying to mobilize a basic income movement is really what we need to do, is to show that we do have the groundswell of society saying it's time for change. And this is the way, this is the path forward.
Earlier on, you mentioned that the cost of living crisis really took off in 2020. If there are people who think of that time, who think of 2020, and their mind goes to, well, at the time there was increased government spending and there was CERB, which people could see as almost a form of
yeah.
basic income.
Yeah.
And they draw a line between those two things and say, well, this whole crisis started when the government started giving everyone money through CERB. What would your response to that kind of sentiment be?
I think by having CERB, we, you know, that was a recovery mechanism. And there were issues with it. I mean, there's no doubt that there were some problems with the sort of how it, you know, rolled out. But we did have our good, robust recovery from COVID-19. And it was largely to do with the CERB. And actually, I think we need to be talking about that more, about the fact that it was a very successful thing in terms of ensuring that families had the income and the, you know, were able to, you know, pay their bills during that time that was so unpredictable and scary for so many. So yes, I mean, there were, I think, forces at play on the global scale, right? And like supply chains and things that did, you know, were affected because of the pandemic. Those were real things. And it did generate this cost of living crisis. I personally think that some of the corporations have used it to be able to say, oh, we can just keep increasing the prices, where like now there's no reason for us to continue having those prices increase. I think we could get better regulations in place to ensure that that doesn't happen. So that's one piece of the puzzle. But the fact that we have such immense poverty, and not only that, some more recent polls, one was done by RBC that basically said half of Canadians are feeling financially paralyzed, is how they phrased it. Another by the Financial Resiliency Institute basically said that 75%, three quarters of society, is feeling financially vulnerable. So it's not just people at the lowest income bands. It's across the income spectrum, unless you're talking at the, you know, top 1% who are feeling quite cushy at this moment because their income keeps going, you know, skyrocketing. But the rest, Lars Osterberg actually says that 90% of us are actually losing ground. So this is not a good trajectory. So those are issues that we also need to address in terms of, you know, income inequality. But something we need to do now to make sure there's an income floor for everybody is to have a basic income guarantee.
You're listening to People First Radio. The program today is focusing on guaranteed basic income and the potential that it could dramatically reduce poverty rates. Right now, I'm speaking with Tracy Smith Carrier. She's a professor at Royal Roads University in Victoria. She's also a Canada Research Chair in advancing the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals. Related to what you just mentioned there, when the Parliamentary Budget Officer's office costed this out, it wasn't like it was a magical free program where everyone is just going to suddenly have more money. In the version of this that they analyzed, which they suggested could lift up to 40% of people in poverty right now out of poverty, it suggested that people in income quintiles 3, 4, and 5, so the wealthiest 60% of income earners, would lose about $1,500 to $2,300 of disposable income on average. Do you think that kind of thing is going to play into opposition to this idea? Or would you suggest, like, what is your response to
how
to best implement this?
Yeah, a great question, because I think that, I mean, the Parliamentary Budget Officer has costed based on the existing by eliminating the existing tax credits and using them to offset the price. So there's nothing carved in stone that says that it has to be that, you know, these the ones in these quintiles are going to, you know, are going to suffer, right? And they aren't actually going to suffer that much anyway. But that doesn't have to be, right? This is just based on the existing offsets, and they could change how the formula so that that doesn't happen and that doesn't play out for those quintiles. What we do need to actually make note of is the folks at the very bottom of the income distribution that will be significantly impacted. So people that are living in what we call deep income poverty, meaning that they're living on less than 75% of the poverty line, the market basket measure, that will substantially raise the bottom. And yes, we can work through the other quintiles to make sure that there's equity there too. So no, I think that's just based on what we have now and what we could take out. But of course, they could play with the numbers to make sure that it is any more even and equitable distribution.
I think even in the universe where that was the formula that we had to go with, it was like that or the status quo. I'm sure there would be a lot of people in the median income distribution who would say, you know what, I would gladly pay $1,500 to eliminate half of poverty in the country. But I guess my question is, do you think that there are enough people out there with political capital who wouldn't want that to happen to make it an obstacle?
I think this is where the message that we need to really let people know that by having a society that has significant poverty affects everybody. So it affects everybody, including billionaires. There are negative societal consequences that happen when you have immense poverty. So I think it would be great for people to be empathetic and care about their fellow, citizens. But if that's not the argument that's going to persuade them, then we need to say, you know what, it's going to affect you and your children and your grandchildren too. And it will affect their health, their mental health. It will affect the sense of community, the sense of collectivity that we have in society. It will affect crime rates. It will, like, there's lots of things that will be impacted and will impact those people directly. So I think that's honestly a message that I think folks need to hear and recognize. But yes, it would be great if we had that empathy that we could care, and we would recognize too that poverty is fundamentally a systemic issue. It's not about individual failings. It's really about what the economic conditions of the day. Do people have access to childcare? Do people have access to good job opportunities, decent wages? Is there a pandemic? I mean, all of these things, these big systemic factors, have a far greater impact on people's lives than this notion that somehow people are responsible for their own poverty.
One thing I've heard brought up in discussions around basic income is, maybe I'll call it a concern, seems like a neutral word, that if such a system were implemented, there would be a ton of jobs no one would want to do, that people would stop doing, and that could have real repercussions in a lot of areas of society.
Yeah, but I don't think that's necessarily borne out in research. I mean, some of the research that came out of the Mincome project was that, no, it did the opposite. Same thing with the Ontario Basic Income Pilot research. We just published a paper on some of the experiences of folks that were involved in that. They were actually advancing with new job opportunities, wanting to start new businesses, pursuing higher education. So it actually provides the money people need to actually move forward with their lives and the plans that they have for themselves. So the Mincome project was interesting because it said, you know, there was this minor decrease in labor force participation. But when they looked at it, you found out that it was actually, you know, parents that decided, moms that wanted to stay at home with their babies for the first year. And it was young people deciding to stay in school longer before they got a job. So if you actually look at the numbers and go, oh, there's a decrease there, they actually start to understand why people may not be going out into the workforce. They could be because they're pursuing other things that have societal value. And then they do proceed to do things and move on with better quality jobs. My hope is that it actually puts some pressure on employers to do better too. That people can say, you know what, no, this is a crappy job. And I mean, we would need to implement it on a large scale and an adequate scale to be able to make those, to get the data on that. But I think that, you know, it'd be interesting to see. My suspicion is that employers would need to raise the bar a little bit to say, no, I'm going to do better, which is better for everybody.
Is there anything else that stood out to you about the PBO's latest work on this subject?
Well, I think it was really neat that it was sort of similar to the work that the PEI project had done in terms of playing around with the numbers with different administrative units to try and find cost savings that I think would be really, really helpful. And also just, I think it's really helpful to know that we can have this like fairly significant cut in poverty and it's very affordable to do. I think that's really the key message out of this is that we can afford this and we could do better. And so I think we need our leaders, provincial, federal. I think we need our leaders to get on board and recognize that.
Earlier this year, I was reading through an MIT Press book on the subject of universal basic income. And in that book, it mentioned that historically around in the 1970s, that this was an idea that sort of had buy-in from across the political spectrum. On the one hand, because some economists thought that this was really simple. It could simplify you could kind of take a machete to a lot of complicated bureaucracy and just simplify it and have this. And on the other hand, it would achieve the goal of lifting a number of people out of poverty, according to the theory.
Yeah.
What happened? Where did we lose steam?
Yeah, that was a great question because it was the same time that we did the Mincome experiment in Manitoba that there were a number of pilots that were being run in the United States, quite similar. And so with quite similar findings, really. And so when I mentioned the fact that, you know, there were these slight decreases, and when I mean slight is like 1%, 2% decreases in workforce participation. And of course, you have the naysayers that want to interpret that in a certain way and say, oh, there's going to be a mass, you know, exodus out of the workforce. And so the pundits got in there. People started debating this without, you know, real explanation about what those numbers meant. And it sort of swung things the other way. Similar in Canada with the pilots that we've run is that we end up starting these pilots and then there's a change in government and the next elected officials decide, yeah, usually for ideological reasons, I don't want to continue with that. We're not going to fund it. We'll cancel it. Or they don't want to continue funding the evaluation of it. And then some of that is lost. But yes, very similar, actually, that happened in the United States as well. And there's you know, great research Carl was involved in as well, talking about the fact that it was a resounding success. It was a resounding success. And yet people have been, you know, with such skepticism about some of these programs because they have such ingrained ideas about deservingness and what people deserve. And, you know, the sense that people shouldn't get money if they haven't earned it is so strong, even though we know if you give people money, they use it in very, very helpful ways for themselves and their families.
How do you think the recent political moment impacts the prospects of basic income in Canada and elsewhere?
I think I would like to be optimistic that to say that, you know what, we need bold ideas right now. We are in a crisis moment and people are really, really struggling. We don't have time to just rehash the same stuff. We're losing ground very quickly. We need to find ways to better tax enough money in the public coffers to ensure that we have the programs and services that people need, and we need to do something about poverty because more and more people are becoming entering into that financially insecure situation, and we need an idea like a basic income that will help society as a whole move forward.
Is there anything else you think it's important to bring to this present moment about basic income?
I think that people need really need to get involved. I think people need to become aware and become more active, and actually show that they're part, that they stand in solidarity with solutions proven in evidence to work. I think so. That's what we've been doing, is trying to get people to sign on a consensus statement to say this is the basic income we want in Canada, and to make sure that our political leaders know that, and that we won't back down.
Tracy Smith Carrier is a professor at Royal Roads University in Victoria and Canada Research Chair in Advancing the UN Sustainable Development Goals. Wednesday, Smith Carrier was one of the speakers at a Canada-wide webinar put on by the Tamarack Institute, a charity that aims to address poverty. Also speaking at that event was Joshua Smee. He's CEO of Food First NL, a food security-focused nonprofit in Newfoundland and Labrador. He shared some perspective about the prospects of basic income in Canada's easternmost province.
Food insecurity is primarily an income problem, right? And that when, for our crew team at Food First NL, so we're a food systems organization, we're working at this kind of at the systems level, trying to connect food organizations to each other, to do advocacy work around the things that need to change in the policy space around food. And it was pretty simple for us to come around to basic income, I'll be honest. I think by and large, it was us asking ourselves the questions of what would be the single policy change that would have the most impact on the thing that we're trying to solve for, right? And it is obviously basic income. There, not to say that there are not other dynamics to food insecurity or to the right to food and to people having access to the foods that make sense to them and in their cultural and family lives, but it's hard to imagine any of that working without adequate income first. And I think for us as well as an organization, I'm sure this is true for lots of other people on this call, we think a lot about dignity, right? You know, it's part of our vision statement at Food First NL is a Newfoundland and Labrador where everyone can eat with joy and dignity. And I think we have a lot of intersection and interaction with the ways in which people who are food insecure, who are primarily folks who are low income, are deprived of dignity by the support systems that they're connecting with, right? I mean, anyone, I'm sure there are folks on this call who probably do have some lived experience of this. You know, accessing food banks, for example, is not often a very pleasant process for a lot of people. And that's no slight against the people who run food banks, but the process of reaching out for help with some of these like deeply challenging things in your life is just one that exposes people to a lot of risk. And I think that's the other thing that brought us into this conversation and into the basic income world. So I think it would be useful for me to contextualize a little bit what's happening in Newfoundland and Labrador. We're on the far end of the country. We're a little place. And so sometimes things don't make it out into the big wide world, but there's quite a bit on the go. And I think it does speak to maybe some strategies that a lot of us can think about here. So I'll give you a sense of where we are. One, and Natasha mentioned this when she was introducing me. So I sat on a panel, an expert panel called the Health Accord, where in Newfoundland and Labrador, we face the same challenges that most Canadian healthcare systems face, but just worse. So we have the worst outcomes and the highest per patient spend of any healthcare system in the country, right? So it's a real crisis. And so people were brought together from across the spectrum. So folks from all over the healthcare kind of stakeholder world, the CEOs of the health authorities, the unions, you know, physicians groups, all these kind of things, but also community partners, including my organization, to guide a process of reimagining not just healthcare, but health, like what would get us to a place where people were healthier. The Health Accord process came back and recommended a basic income twice in the final report, for the simple reason that there's no way to achieve what needs to happen in the transformation of our health outcomes without dealing with the social determinants of health, right? And so I think when we think about what are the levers on provincial policy, like provinces spend most of their money on health. It's half of the provincial budget. And so if we're not moving the basic income conversation to the health conversation, we're going to lose. And so in Newfoundland, it has really been part of that conversation, and that has been moving things forward because that has a lot of political weight. I'll also mention there, we have now three targeted basic incomes is what folks call them here. I think there's, we could get into a debate about the degree to which these are or are not basic incomes, but we do have one program for youth exiting care. So when you leave leave care at age 18, you're provided with a basic income to help you get on your feet as an independent adult. It's a very small group of youth who qualify for this one. Similarly, and some folks have actually might have seen a news story about this one this week in the Canadian press or last week. There's a basic income program for near seniors. So we have folks who are on income support, which is our social assistance program, and receiving what's called community supports, which is a healthcare program. So for folks with lots of health vulnerabilities, once you turn 60, you're now offered this basic income pilot that brings you up to what your income will be when you turn 65. Because we know that lots of outcomes for people get better when they turn 65 and have access to what is in effect a basic income, right? So this is only a few hundred people. And I think this one is an interesting one to follow because it's been challenging to enroll people in it. I think there's probably about a third of the people who can be enrolled have been. And so we're following that one closely. The bigger one here, which is rolling out in July, is that the province here is rolling out a provincial disability benefit that will stack on top of the national one. So the national one is $200 a month, which, as we know, is really meager. But our provincial government is stacking $400 more on top of that. And so for the lowest income folks with disabilities, that'll be, you know, a 50% increase in their income overnight. It's quite significant. And they're calling it a basic income, which I think all three of these, we can debate about whether they are, but the language of basic income is there. We also have an all-party committee studying basic income. They are finally about to report. They're very late, but we do expect their report to land, and I would expect it to recommend again in favor of basic income. And there's a review of our income support system happening. So lots of things on the go at the same time. The policy environment is pretty fruitful out here. And part of why that's happening is, I think, Newfoundland and Labrador is a bit of a unique political context for this kind of work. There's a lot of common ground between the three dominant political parties here around poverty reduction. So if you look back to the 2010s, this province is the only province in Canada that has actually shown that food insecurity can be decreased at the population level. And that happened during a progressive conservative government who had a really aggressive poverty reduction strategy. And the PCs here still kind of feel like they own poverty reduction. When the new PC leader was elected, I heard him on the radio the morning after he took over the party, going off about how income support needs to be indexed to inflation, right? Like, so this is, I think we do have an unusual political context here. If you close your eyes in a meeting of the All-Party Committee on Basic Income, you wouldn't know who the New Democrat and who the Conservative was. And so that does provide a little bit more continuity. And I think that's something we have in common with Prince Edward Island, and why the two provinces have made progress is because it's not that our political parties don't hate each other, but they don't hate each other for this particular reason. And so it allows for a little bit more continuity there. A polling company called the Gandalf Group was contracted by the Maple Leaf Center for Food Security to do some polling on attitudes towards poverty reduction policies and social policy. And they oversampled in Newfoundland and Labrador because the Maple Leaf Center is doing a bunch of work out here, which gave us, for once, a really good local sample in a small province. And I draw your attention, you know, look at how many people support a minimum income floor that would provide a safety net for all Canadians? If you look at Canada at large, it's 40% say it's very desirable, another 34 say somewhat, so you're at 75%. If you go to Newfoundland and Labrador, 55 and 35, so you have 90% of people saying it's either somewhat or very desirable that we have a minimum income floor. So there is a really significant difference in terms of the political will behind these kind of changes. And there is, I think, a more cross-partisan consensus that government has a role to play in this particular way. And this chart's interesting because it shows that that's actually consistently true across most areas of social policy. The last thing I'll just talk about to give people, again, a little bit of a worked example, then I'll get off the line here, or at least recede into the background a bit. is just what basic income advocacy is looking like right now in Newfoundland and Labrador, because again, I think it's a little bit different. There might be some lessons to learn. We do have a long-standing tradition of grassroots advocacy, primarily led by faith leaders. So we have an interfaith group that's been at it forever, doing a ton of letter writing, particularly to federal MPs. And then what we see then is a second kind of wave of basic income organizing started happening out of COVID. So a bunch of us started organizing around, you know, probably what a lot of people on this call were involved in. So what would a just recovery from the pandemic look like? Our organization provided a bit of backbone support to that organizing, getting things written down and a website built. One of the things that came out of that just recovery organizing was a lot of interest in basic income. And so a network of community organizations formed Basic Income NL. So I think that's one thing that's different about Basic Income NL as an organizing group compared with some other areas, is it's mostly paid staff. It's mostly EDs and CEOs and stuff of community organizations from a pretty wide range of disciplines who all see that basic income would be the most transformative possible policy for them. So there's youth organizations, mental health folks, anti-poverty folks, women's organizations, food organizations, all there. And I think that coalition building format has been really effective because individually, each of our organizations have a fair bit of access to decision makers. We also have things like paid communications people. We wrote our own policy paper and reached out to Harvey Stevens, who'd done the early costing for PEI, and just paid him to update his model with our data because we had a bit of money that we could do that. And we were able to table with the province the first cost estimates of what basic income would cost in the province. And that just started a bit of a process moving with our provincial government. So I think being able to reach out and do government's work for them a little bit helped, because then a committee formed internally to deal with what we just dropped on their desks, right? That's been an effective thing. The other effective piece we've seen is that basic income here has been included in Indigenous-led advocacy in Newfoundland and Labrador. So there's a Indigenous policy coalition here that is prioritizing basic income quite strongly. And that has helped move the needle. And the final thing I'll say is just that in a small province, and I think there are other small provinces on this call, take advantage of the media environment, right? Like, we have lots of access to our local media, to the public conversation as a community organization in a way that you wouldn't in Ontario or British Columbia, maybe. And the basic income movement has really been able to leverage that. And I think that's been a part of the reasons we got where we are.
Joshua Smee, CEO of Newfoundland and Labrador-based nonprofit Food First NL, speaking at a webinar on basic income held February 26th. It was hosted by Waterloo-based charity, the Tamarack Institute.
This is People First Radio, coming to you on CHLY 101.7 FM in Nanaimo, on CFMH Local 107.3 FM in St. John, and on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria.
The program so far has been all about basic income. We've heard from the authors of an analysis on the subject from the Office of the Parliamentary Budget Officer. It suggested that poverty rates could be cut by 40% in 2025 if Canada were to implement a basic income model. Nasreddine Amar and Marianne Lorrain are the authors of that analysis. Louis Perrault also works within the office of the PBO. I spoke with all three of them. What are some of the other things that aren't tackled in the report that are maybe factors of uncertainty, things that we would never know how they go until a program is implemented and we see in the real world?
Good question. Actually, many, many things. Actually, one of the things is the parameters of the GBI itself. So like we have in our exercise, we have considered, like we said, the parameters that are included in Ontario project. But the parameters could be different. Actually, you can, one thing that you can change, for example, like instead of calculating the maximum amount based on LIM, low income measure, that was the case with our exercise, it could be different measure based on MBM, for example, or based on LICO, and that could give you different impacts, actually. Like we have seen with the family definition itself, when we have changed the family definition, only the only thing that we have changed from nuclear family to economic family, the result has changed. Like the gross cost has been reduced to half. And like even like distribution impact, an impact on labor poverty, for example, was different. That's one of stuff that could be considered as kind of uncertainty, because we don't know really what will be the official GBI, right? If it's, for example, if the government decides to adopt it. The other thing is about the program that will be replaced. Like the list of program could be different, and how you fund, the way how you fund your GBI also could be different. All that elements actually could interact and could affect the results in terms of distributional and fiscal analysis.
There's something else to the uncertainty with respect to the actual things that we say in terms of how people respond. Most of these parameters used when we're trying to measure responses to tax and transfer system changes, so these elasticities, right, which are the measures of how people respond. These are taken from studies, and usually they're on small changes. And often, you know, you do get that people don't change their behavior that much. But one thing that, you know, will be taught usually in Econ 101 is that on the long term, you know, the people's behavior, you know, change quite a bit. You know, they find new ways of adapting. So usually these elasticities, you know, those measures of responses are usually quite larger. So there could be very well be bigger responses, people working less, you know, much more than what we emphasize in the report, because, you know, that's the only measures are usually measures on very short term responses. So that's also another source of uncertainty, you know. And as an economist, you would usually try to point out that these are possible changes. You know, that proposal, you know, if you look at all the tax credits, all the changes to the tax system to justify this, you know, being able to pay for the GBI is significant. You know, it's not a very small change. So it would entail important changes. And, you know, some people argue, well, no, these tax credits are better targeted, perhaps for, you know, to achieve specific policy goals. And that, you know, like, it's true, you're aiming for this one, but you're sacrificing something else. And that's usually sometimes what, you know, people that are not as keen on the idea would highlight. It's like, well, no, this is a large change, and this might not be as targeted. And also, in the long run, like, we have very little idea of, like, how fundamental the changes to actual labor markets would be impacted by such an important policy.
Is there any context I need to add to this understanding? So if we're looking at the cost of a guaranteed basic income program, it's not that we're saying, oh, you know, we'll just hand wave some tax credits and there will be no real impact on your life. In your analysis, you've put some numbers on what that impact on someone's life could be. And you suggested that, say, if I'm in the middle income in Canada, I might have $1,500 less because of the cost of guaranteed basic income. If I am in the highest quintile, I might have just over $2,000 less because of basic income's implementation. Like, is there any other context I need to know, or is it a relatively reasonable assumption to say, in this framework, if we were to implement this, this is what it would cost me if I had that kind of income, about $2,000.
I think, as Louis just said, implementing a GBI as we've defined it in our report is a very big change in how the tax system is currently structured. And so some people might gain significantly, more specifically lower income people, but also eliminating a lot of the tax measures that we've listed in our report can affect a lot of people as well. And so the numbers, the effects or the impact on disposable income of households that we present in our report are averages by total income quintile. But within the quintiles, there could be gainers and quote-unquote losers that they could experience a loss in their disposable income because of the extent of the change in how the system would be. So that's what I would highlight.
Is there anything we haven't talked about so far today that you think it's important to highlight about your work or bring to a conversation about this analysis of guaranteed basic income in Canada and what it could look like?
I mean, like I said before, when you look on this analysis, you need to be careful how you read it. It's just, this report give you very good affirmative analysis about the fiscal distribution and impact of one scenario of GBI if it's implemented. But again, like this kind of analysis is very sensitive to different assumptions that you are undertaking. That's first thing. And then does not give you, of course, the complete picture, which is to say, initially the same output from different reports of PBO, because for example, one thing, we are not here to recommend policy, like Louis said. So one thing that we don't compare between different policies and see what's one more efficient, for example. Other thing, we are not here to do that kind of cost-benefit analysis. So our main focus was really the fiscal impact. And then government, and of course on households, on people. And that's something that we have focused on. But for certain, you need to complete that study with different other aspects of behavior impact, let's say it, or cost-benefit analysis if you want more complete picture of it.
Nasreddin Amar, Marianne Laurent, and Louis Perrault all work within the Office of the Parliamentary Budget Officer. That is all the time we have for the show today. You've been listening to People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh. A reminder to check on the web for old episodes of the program. You can just search People First Radio, or you can find us on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Thank you so much for tuning in. I hope you can join me again next week.
People First Radio is a community media project of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society and produced in Nanaimo, British Columbia. The opinions expressed do not necessarily represent the views of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society or its broadcast partners.